Welcome to this segment of Subscribe, my blog on Channel 9. And I want to talk about environments and scale units. Those are two terms that we use inside this service bus team. The reason why I'd like to share them with you is because service bus is a set of features that we provide to you, but it's also a large distributed service that runs on top of Windows Azure. So it's not unlike the things that you will build on top of the platform. We're running on cloud services, we're using the SQL database, we're using the blob store and the table store, so we're using assets much as your applications would use them. So I thought it might be interesting to share how we're structuring our system and how we are thinking about environments, data centers effectively, and also how we think about scale units and scaling the system from a conceptual level. I'm not going to go into the details how we do that in detail in Service Bus because that's actually not very helpful. But I'd like to get the principles across and talk about those in general. So we have 8 data centers across the world today. There will be more coming. And so in each of these data centers, Service Bus obviously has a production environment. So that's our first kind of environment, and we call this short prod, because auction is much too long. So we have a production environment, and that production environment exists in all of those different places. I'm not going to put anything into those columns because for the scale units, we're going to get to that. And then in addition to the production environment, we also have a pre-production environment, which we call PPE, the pre-production environment. Our production environment is a set of machines that actually contains scale units. Bear with me. The scale units are running this production environment, and they're always on. And you should not confuse production and PPE with production and staging as a concept as you have it in cloud services. We actually never use the staging slot in our deployments. Every scale unit, and bear with me, every deployment unit, let me call it that for the moment, every deployment unit that we have, we're only ever using the production slot and that we upgrade them in place. We have to do this because we have a promise. And we make a promise, and the promise is an SLA. The SLA is, system is going to have 99.95% uptime. That promise is nothing that we can take as license to go and be down 0.05% of the time. Because in a distributed system, in a large cloud system that as we run it, there is 0.05% enough risk for other things to go down so that you will never intentionally try to go down. Instead, our goal is for every single environment to be up 100% of the time, and we're designing towards that point. So our production environment is nothing that we can swap out or have another thing sit here and then swap out. I mean, we about twice to swap things out with some Jedi, those later as well. So, but the production environment is always on. So first thing, for each environment, the cloud service that runs, we always do in-place upgrades. We use the upgrade facility that is part of the Windows Azure Cloud Services deployment process. So let me talk about that briefly, how that works. We're separating out in upgrade domains. I'm showing 4 here. And in those upgrade, and so if you have a deployment of 16 machines, let's make those 16 machines here quickly. I could sing a song while I'm drawing. Or you can look at my bald spot in my head. 16 machines, and they're split into those upgrade domains. The upgrade domains is something that's a concept that you have in Windows Azure Cloud Services. So as the system upgrades, what we do is we supply a package, the new package to the Windows Azure Fabric Controller, and now based on it knowing that you have these upgrade domains, what it will do, it will take a quarter, now if I have set up this 4, it will take a quarter of the population and we'll go and take those out of commission effectively, boot those machines. Since these are cloud services, they're stateless, which means it effectively throws them away, and then brings up deploys the new bits onto that machine and brings it up in a new state. There's a state machine behind this. There's a callback function that the cloud service can implement where it can learn what state it is in, whether it's whether the upgrade is in progress, whether the upgrade has is happening, or whether the upgrade has completed. And based on that, the new bits or the old bits can be active, or the application can choose to enable new features or not enable new features, depending on when machines need to talk to each other. But the goal here of these upgrade domains is that there's always the remaining capacity available for customer traffic. So as we're taking a quarter of the capacity of this scale unit out of commission, the other three quarters are still there to take the customer traffic. Once this is upgraded, the fabric controller proceeds to the next one, proceeds to the next one, proceeds to the next one. So we're always doing that inside those production environments all the time. Now, sometimes these upgrades are a little more involved, and they obviously include databases. We're sitting on top of all the other Windows services. So we have SQL databases, we have table stores, we have all kinds of other things. And sometimes you have to have a schema change or schema addition, etc. So there are scripts that need to be run, and sometimes you can't make all the steps compatible. So some of those things might be a little more involved and a little more complicated. Mind that all of these steps, everything that needs to happen, you know, whatever sequence it needs to happen, whether you need to make a new database and copy the data over and do that in a recurring fashion as you are bleeding off the old database, and then bring, as you have upgraded the bits, then do a switch over. There's all kinds of things that you can do depending on what the kind of upgrade is. Based on how complicated that is, you need to go and simulate that step, and you best simulate that step in the place where you will actually want to do that upgrade. That is what PPE is for, the pre-production environment is for. So if we have a fairly complex upgrade process that involves schema changes or other changes that we need to make to the environment, which is more than just putting new bits onto the machines, then we use PPE, the pre-production environment, as the simulation environment. PPE gets deployed with the old existing bits that sit in that respective environment. There might be slight differences between what's deployed in which data center. Typically, the bits are exactly the same. There are, depending on what scale unit you're in, again, bear with me on scale units, I'm going to get there in a moment. There might be some slight differences, but as a matter of course, just to be safe, we're doing these pre-production tests, the PPE tests, individually in each data center. So the way the PPE environment works is we start with a deployment of the old bits that are running in production right now. We load that system with some data and we start running some testing. And then as we are running that under moderate load, which is simulating what's going to happen in the production environment, we take the new bits and then start rolling that upgrade on that particular scale unit. And we're doing that effectively under production conditions. And we observe what happens in the pre-production environment. And believe me, we have found some really evil bugs as we're doing pre-production deployment, even after all the testing that we're doing normally. So it's a really good safety net to use. And so once that has all succeeded in PPE, then you have sign-off to actually go into production. And then we go and take those bits and run the exact same procedures to go and update the production environment. And so far, the PPE safety net has been very good to us and has caught all the things that all the potential problems we would have had going into production, which is very bad if that happens, ahead of time. So that's the role of pre-production. The nice thing about the pre-production environment and the nice thing about being, you know, on a flexible cloud environment is we sometimes need to have a bunch of capacity here for individual deployments, where we need sometimes capacity of over 100 nodes, over 100 VMs. And so for PPE, when we stand this up, we do this just for deployment. So as a matter of a day or two, we can just grab that extra capacity, go and check things out, do some smoke tests, do some some light runs to see whether the system is actually holding up in that environment for 24 hours, et cetera, et cetera. And once that's done, we just tear it down and throw it away. The environments are also configuration buckets, effectively. We have a deployment system. The deployment system is unfortunately not in the shape that we can go and share that with you. I would love to do that, but it's not in a shippable packaged condition. It's actually just, you know, it's part of the depot that we are running this out of. And what the configuration system does, let me explain that, is you have the normal application.configuration files and web.configuration files, all the things that are necessary to run the system, and also obviously the Windows Azure deployment configuration files. As said, these, what we're running is our normal services. And those need various configurations for the different environments. Let me go and talk about those briefly, and that's how we actually get to the notion of scale units. So we have a set of configurations. Let me just say it's a config file, and that config file has some inputs. It has some inputs about data that comes in from. It has some inputs about, you know, the SQL databases that are needed. So there's a SQL a server actually, or a SQL database server. There's this container concept in the Windows Azure SQL database. So they have a server. So we configure the server, and then we also configure certain databases to go into that configuration. There's some dynamicism that we have here for specifically also for the messaging containers, because the messaging containers are living inside the SQL database, so they need to if they need to have additional capacity, we can actually add that capacity very dynamically, so not all that data sits in the configuration file, but the baseline information sits in that configuration file. Then there's other information that goes in there, for instance, for diagnostics. We need table store and blob store accounts, where our systems are producing their own dumps. They're obviously producing all these different kinds of trace files and log files. So that needs to be configured for a particular environment. Then we have our billing system that we feed data into. We have our usage system, which needs to configure it in a particular way. So there's a lot of resources that are belonging, a lot of resources that belong to a particular deployment. The way we are managing those deployments and those dependencies is through scale units. The notion here is that we don't want to have, we don't want to put all the eggs into one basket, effectively. And also, we want to be we want to have a predictable system. And making those things predictable is actually very hard unless you have a way to go and test those out. So that's where the way you can test an entire system to a certain scale point violently, and you know exactly when it goes down. If you just scale your system up and you just hope it will scale to infinity, it typically will not. So what we're doing is we have very well thought out and tested out scale points. And we are configuring these particularities into the deployments, into those deployments that are scaled to a particular point. So these things we call scale units. A scale unit in Service Bus consists of a gateway. Gateway are the machines that you talk to on Service Bus. If you come in and you talk to us, you're talking through the gateway. The gateway is the thing that knows protocol. So it knows HTTP, it knows AMQP now, it knows the SBMP, Service Bus Management Messaging Protocol, so it knows all those, and it knows the NetTCP protocols for relay, so it knows all those protocols and does the right thing with them. The relay also lives inside that gateway. And then there is the messaging backend. And then there's a range of databases that we run behind this. The gateway has one, and the messaging system has a ton of them. And then there's another resources. There's tables, and there's blobs for all kinds of diagnostics purposes. And the interesting thing is that all of these things have certain maximum scale points. You can only get so much throughput out of a single SQL database. You can only get so much throughput out of a single table store partition. So all these things are somewhat scale constrained. And that's actually true for a lot of systems. You can scale this out as much as you'd like, but ultimately, if you're writing to data and if you need to have access to data, then actually the data scaling is much, much harder than the stateless scaling that happens up in the front. And because the world is in distributed systems is full of surprises, and the more scale you have in your system, the more machines you have in the system, the more surprises you're going to get. We're trying to be conservative on the scale and actually go and build stamps that we know exactly how they behave, and then we make more of them. So we're going to scale these. I'm giving you just some numbers. They are not necessarily what we run, because that actually varies. Let's say we're going to do a 16-16. We're going to have 16 compute nodes at the front, and we're going to have 16 compute nodes at the back. And then we're going to have a number of databases. Let's say we're going to have 20 databases here. We're going to have two databases for the policy store, and then we're going to have four accounts for this that we're going to go and scale across. That is a configuration that you can test, and that is a configuration that you can go and test and bring to a breaking point. Once you know what that breaking point looks like, you can also spot it. You can see how the system behaves in the running up to it and when the system actually keels over because it has too much load. So you can actually go and look at those thresholds and how the system behaves, and you can go and spot when the system is under too much load. And then you go to the next well-known scale point and effectively just inflate the system to the next point where you know the exact characteristics. And likely, that's where you stop. Maybe we go higher here, but we only have, it's like click stops that you have in their system. We start with 2x2. That's the smallest deployment we can make. And then we typically run in clusters of 64 machines, 48 machines. There's some well-known cluster sizes that we have. Those are typically sufficient for even the most brutal load that we can get from our customers, because turns out 32x32, that's a lot of horsepower to throw at a problem servicing a particular application. Now, of course, we need to scale this out across tens of thousands of namespaces, tens of thousands of different customers, and using this namespace concept is actually scaling concept is actually very useful for this. If you create a namespace, you're going to land in one of those scale units. Those scale units have a name. So let's say we have one that's in US North. So this is going to be US North 1. That's the name of it. I can go and make US North 2. Now these are not our real names so this is looking exactly the same, an exact copy. So how do we allocate resources to it? Well, we have above this, let me go and wipe this away so I have a little bit more room. As you come to us and you want to create a namespace, you're actually walking up to the portal typically, or in the very near future, you can also do that via PowerShell. You walk up to the provisioning system through the portal. It's the thing that sits kind of behind the covers, under the covers, and says, make me a namespace. The provisioning system has a catalog that knows about the status of all those scale units around the world. Let me just put some numbers here. Again, I'm just going to make those up. So let's say in US North we're running 8, we're running 4 here, we're running 3 here, we're running 4 here, 8 here, 4 here, 6 here, and let's say 2 here. These are the scale units that we have in the system. So now as you create a namespace, as you create a tenant effectively, you come to us, and the provisioning system has a catalog, knows about all those numbers, and also knows about how what the load is on those individual scale units, how many namespaces have actually been provisioned into those. It will look at your request and say, ah, so you want to go into the US West data center, and we have a capacity of, let's say, 50,000 namespaces per scale unit. And so it will go and see where we have capacity and we'll try to level things out. So we'll see three, we'll see how many namespaces are provisioned in here, and then place you into the one with the lowest load. If we bring up a brand new scale unit, number three, to the third, we just add a fourth one, well then in that case, that new scale unit is going to get all the new namespace activations and won't get any traffic until that's all leveled out. If we take one away, which is something we will rarely do, what we would do if we had to declare bankruptcy on a scale unit, which is very grave, that would have been very grave circumstances. We have not never done that. We will likely never do that because our system is meant to be agile to go across. But then we could actually very easily redistribute the load across the existing namespaces. Also, we know what the load is, so as we're observing our systems, usage is a very interesting and important thing. As we observe the usage of every individual namespace, we can go and average those out, and we can go and effectively predict how much load we can take onto every individual scale unit. So we could say we could do 50,000 of those namespaces, or we can only do 2,000, and we, knowing the customers, we have some throttles in the system around the number of entities you can create, and those throttles make people call our help desk, and if they call our help desk, the help desk will, with those requests, typically come to us, and we'll then get in touch with the customer and say, hey, what are you planning to do? Typically, those requests end up in a quick consulting call that say, maybe a better idea if you do it this way. But sometimes the customers actually have legitimate requirements that are driving the scale, that are driving scale up. So in that case, we actually have the ability to go and pin a particular customer to a particular scale unit and then give them a higher load factor so that they can get some reserve capacity. That's an ability that we also have in the system. Now, but the nice thing is, because we have predictability in the system, we also know exactly what the capacity could be. So if you and have the average, a notion of the average load. So if you come in, there's four namespaces here. You want to go into US West, and we say the house is full. We will say the house is full. We won't give you a namespace if all the scale units are loaded. Now, of course, if we have to reject you, if we know that the house is full, we'll stand up a new scale unit. And actually, the levels and all that data is transparent. We are looking at this, and as we're looking at this, we can see what the fill levels are and can be proactive and say, we have a trend line and seeing how many namespaces are being created every week. And so looking at that trend line, looking at the levels, we can actually go and see where capacity is needed and go and stand that up. Or we can actually go and be predictive and say, all right, so we need, and we have the choice between standing up entirely new scale units or just taking small ones and inflating them, and then with that also up the capacity numbers. So that's a very useful tool to be predictable and have a very clear notion of a capacity, and then have a effectively a provisioning service which is in the know about all the levels and then can go and assign those things. Now, you'll say, well, my service is not service bus. It must be different. Well, that all depends. If you're a... So let me tell you what the characteristics are of service bus. Service bus is very nice for this kind of scale out because all the individual customers are actually completely insulated. There's no interconnection, interdependency between these individual customers, these individual namespaces. They're running complete isolation, kind of side by side, and there's effectively walls erected between them. But that's true for a lot of different systems. What we see at the bottom, so if we come back to this picture, at the bottom there's actually an out for data that's being produced out of that skillet that actually goes into shared resources. So let me go and make that a. Let me take this one. Right. So just forget that it's messaging, because Service Bus is measuring things around the system and is spewing them out towards billing. Now, billing is clearly a common infrastructure. Everybody gets a bill. And so we're collecting data towards a particular subscription, and then we're sending that data out. That goes across namespaces. That actually goes across all of these namespaces, and it needs to flow all in the bill. So if you come and create eight namespaces, you create them one in each data center, all that information, the billing data, needs to flow towards one bill. So there is actually data that comes out of here that's flowing out. So at the bottom kind of each of those scale units, there might actually be outflux of data, and then actually maybe influx of data. You may have information that you post somewhere in some bucket that then gets distributed, and actually Service Bus is a very nice mechanism for that, that then gets distributed into other data buckets that sit somewhere else. I will not claim that I know how Facebook is built. However, it's actually a picture you can use for that, is that your feed that you're posting to, Twitter is the same model, is actually a vertical bucket that's just for you. And then as you're posting into your bucket, into your timeline, there's subscribers hanging off that timeline, and they have their own bucket, but your timeline is ultimately composed from subscriptions that you have on other people. And whenever something happens in some other place, that's a notification that comes to your bucket, but ultimately you walk up to your bucket, you walk up to your timeline, and that's where you get your data from. You're going to be hearing about scale units a lot as I'll talk about more architectural patterns, because that's a foundational thing that we believe is a very, very good idea to keep things predictable and scalable. So that much about scale units. You're going to hear more about this and the application of scale units as I'll talk about individual architectural approaches. Let me take that away and fill this out. So of the pre-production environment, as I said, we're only running this on demand. I'm hoping that I'm not writing any offensive Chinese characters as I'm writing these, what is supposed to be asterisks. This is probably offensive. All right, good. And let's talk about the other environments, because there's this and then there's more, because we also test those things. We also test our system. And the next time I'm recording a video, I have to make a note that I actually turn off all these sounds and go into presentation mode, so apologies for that. We have an additional set of test environments. They're the same kind of structure. We have, first of all, a BVT environment, the build verification test environment. BVT stands for, build verification test, and we're using that environment for doing testing after we have done an official build. So the way that works in our world is everybody, the time now is that all of Redmond wakes up, so now they're actually sending messages. Let's see whether that works. The build verification environment is for testing out the build that is being created nightly. Developers have an environment that is a simulation of the cloud environment. It's not Service Bus Server. That's a very different thing. It's a local simulation of the cloud environment, and that's what they run in their local machine to do some local testing. And then our continuous integration environment, which is a big old predecessor to the new TFS build environment or continuous integration environment, that environment also runs that local version. Now, the BVT version is the environment that we stand up in an automated fashion effectively, And that's where we deploy the bits and then actually run a very large test suite, much larger than what we run for every check-in. And we run that against the BBT environment. So that's being stood up on a daily basis. All old bits are thrown out. It's seeded with some data, and then it gets punished by a large set of tests. We actually do a lot of regression testing there too. So we run old bits against the new environment, see whether we break protocol, et cetera, et cetera. So all that happens in BBT. Then we have integration environments. Int 1 through int 9. And they're called int for historical reasons mostly, because they were meant to be integrating with other partners. Meanwhile, that's just a common phrase for test environment, really. And they are used for various purposes. Sometimes we make one of those int environments available to a partner for even 3-4 weeks. We just deploy a version of the whatever comes out of the daily build and then let them party on that. And then we effectively go and have an agreement on what the update frequency is, and then they can go and use that. For instance, we just announced the AMQP protocol support, and obviously if you announce that kind of support, you've done some testing, you've been running this ahead of time. So AMQP has been living in an int environment for about at least 6 months. So we could go and test that. So those int environments are used for stress testing, they're used for endurance testing meaning the system is being punished with maximum load for 48 hours. This stress testing where the system is being punished in different ways until it breaks. And there's all kinds of testing scenarios that are being run in the int environments, and there's also private development of samples, private development of best practice applications, all kinds of things are happening against those int environments. And all of those environments typically run bits that are currently being developed in the current milestone that are not ready for public consumption. Really, the first time when we have public consumption bits, they go effectively straight to production. To be frank, mostly what I am using is production. Our cadence is such in development that we go out into the data center every about 6 weeks with new bits. And it's often good enough if I start working against, if I work against a production environment, and then follow effectively the new developments as they are being developed in theory and looking at the code base rather than trying things out myself. I often do that, not with everything, but with many things. I do that straight against the production environment. So you're not missing anything if we're not sharing things during the 6 weeks or sometimes 3 months that it takes us to build a completely new feature. So that's the secret. So of all of those environments, we typically run a single scale unit. So here it is effectively scale unit equals environment. We have some agility to go and run those integration environments across different data centers. And that's actually something we do. We run the BVT environment, the build verification environment, typically very close by as we can make it. The other environments are effectively distributed across the world as we have capacity, or if we want to test our particular scenarios, then we can go and take those environments, the configuration files, and make them agile. So we actually have effectively scale unit configurations for all of those environments for each of these data centers for in terms of addresses and pre and reserved accounts, etc. So that's the last thing I want to talk about. And that is how that's structured, how we talk to those things. So the setup for a scale unit and the setup for an environment is such that you have reserve capacity. So you have, for instance, an account. So you figure out a name for your service. Ours is Service Bus, and we were early. So we are just SB, but so you have your own solution. You are company ABC, and therefore, if you're very lucky, I don't think you will be, it's ABC as a prefix, and now you can go and effectively do all the productions here. So you make an ABC prod USW. So that's your production environment in USW. And now with this name, you go and make a SQL, you make SQL databases, a database, two databases, three databases. You basically just go and name the suffixes here. You probably want to have a database, actually a SQL server database, SQL database server in that particular data center affiliated with that. So you can go and effectively put databases in there. So you want to go and name that. And then you want to name the databases all with those prefixes. You want to have a table store account that's affiliated with that, also with that same name. You want to have a service bus namespace if you need one, also affiliated with that. And also name your compute deployment like this. The nice thing in Windows Azure, with exception of the data of databases per se, because the databases actually incur a cost as you have them, but the server doesn't, is that you can reserve most names without any issues, without any additional cost. So you can go and set those things up. So if you are planning a worldwide deployment and you're planning those different environments, it doesn't hurt if you go in and effectively create all those names. So you create, you know, eight or however many accounts you need to make for storage and for compute, and you have effectively all these empty slots. You know, as long as you don't have anything deployed, that's fine, and have those things sitting there. So based on this, and so with this composition of names, now that gives you also a nice way to go and switch around those configuration files, because you don't need to go and put everything in there. But if you follow a scheme like this, then the only thing you have to truly put into your configuration file as a fixed thing is really the prefix, and then the rest is something you can go and construct. So you can go in your configuration system, go in and effectively flip a switch. You can even, you can probably do this even dynamically and say, this deployment is for US West production, and with that, if you follow that scheme through all the resources that you're talking to and how you name them, you can actually piece together the rest of the addresses that you have. There's something to be said also about, of course, keys. Keys is something that you'll probably have to go and manage individually, but certainly this will help with the addresses, and also will see, you will very easily see what the affinities are. Yeah, so one thing I missed here, obviously, that was very stupid, is this was that was the simple one, right? I missed the scale unit number. So ABC production number one in US West, that's the appropriate prefix for your system. So so much to naming. One last thing. How do we map users? Now, take this and say this is actually the name for your cloud server. So this is .cloudapp.net. Now, let's say you're running also a multi-tenant service. Well, then what you do is you can go and effectively alias your clients to that name. We do this in Service Bus. You have, you know, a name. You have your namespace name, .servicebus.windows.net. The nice thing about that is that we can go and we do two things. First of all, we serve you up one cert. We're going to change that in the very near future, too. We're working on that right now. Not clear when that's going to ship yet. I certainly hope that it's going to be early next year or mid-next year, because most of the other services are doing that already, to have individual custom domain names that you can overlay, kind of CNAME over service, but you can't do that yet, mostly because of SSL, because we don't allow you to bring your own certs yet, and we require for practically everything SSL, so you would have to have the matching cert. But so this is this scale unit here is actually CNAMED by your individual name. So if I have clemens.servicebus.windows.net, let me just make that short, clemens.servicebus.windows.net, that's a CNAME record pointing to this scale unit. The nice thing is about this, the CNAME redirection, is that if I were moving you, and we have done that before, then I can go and effectively switch that over very nicely, and I can go and move you from, let's say, US West to US North if I had to, because I can just manipulate that CNAME. And what we've done also is we have gone and we have changed this name. So effectively, this is the deployment name that we choose. We have another level of indirection, which you also might find interesting. So we give these, so this is the cloudapp.net name that we have. And I said, we're not going to do in place, we always do in place upgrades. That's true, except for when it doesn't work. So we have had two cases where, two occurrences, where we had to effectively take the tablecloth from the whole decked out table and just pull it out with all the glasses standing, and then throw a new tablecloth underneath, under the condition of 99.95% uptime. Effectively changed the entire architecture from underneath and kept the system running. So if you do something like this, you do something that's you do something different. You stand up two scale units, and then you bleed all the data over, and you effectively just keep copying, and then as you copy and you are current, then you switch everybody over. The way you switch everybody over is you need to have an indirection, so that's what we introduced there, in that we have, actually in our own service bus naming, we have another way of taking the scale unit description and then also alias that to service bus of Windows.net itself. So there are some reserved names in that world. So that's an alias. And then there's another alias that's being made by from the individual namespaces. So namespace.servicebus.windows.net, which now gives us two indirections. With that, we can go and take the, this entire deployment that we have and it kind of rehost it on a different place. So what we've done in this case is effectively we took this alias and rehosted it to a different deployment. And then we also have the way to go and rehost individual clients. So we can, with these DNS tricks, and with dialing up and down the TTL, we actually have a chance to go and be very flexible about, you know, moving things out if it really needs to be. Typically, what we do is what I told you, and that's we're going to do those in-place upgrades. One of the core principle that we have in running all those things is we are up 24/7, and actually 24/365, we're always there, and we never take those things down. So a lot of that complication, a lot of that is actually coming out of the need to be on at all times. So I hope that kind of this explanation was useful to you to kind of get a little bit of an insight into how we're structuring our system, you know, the notion of scale units, the notion of environments, and how we think about environments, and how those two notions, the scale unit and the environment, and you know, data center, are finding their are represented and are actually finding their way into artifacts that are actually in the solution. So thank you if you have been staying with me until now, and I hope you like this, and I'll see you again in the next segment.